Bill, thanks for coming on today. Really appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedule. I'm super pumped to get into some of the details of talking the rotational and power athlete today. Before we do that, why don't you just let everyone kind of know who you are, where you're from, and what your background is?
Yeah, so my name's Bill Miller. I'm CSCS certified, and I train mostly baseball players, a few javelin players, javelin throwers outside of the Chicagoland area. And I've kind of just been creating more and more of a social media following over the past couple of years, trying to dive more deeply into how some of the training methods might transfer really well over to rotational power. And recently I wrote a book called Swing Fast, A Guide to Rotational Power, about swing development and how to create as much of that swing power as possible.
Yeah, I mean, in that book as well, I haven't actually read it, so that's my guilty hands up here. But I've heard very good things so far. It's on my list to get once I get through a few more books. But I've heard really good things. Why don't you just go into a few, get your little plug out of the way early here? Why don't you just explain the reasons behind you putting out that resource and a few of the concepts that are in it?
For me personally, I was a baseball player growing up. I played for about 20, 25 years. Tried to go down the professional baseball route, but I just kept getting released by low-level professional teams, so never really worked out for me. But this is kind of the book that I wish I had when I was 18 years old, where I was a big, strong kid who had been lifting weights for 4 or 5 years up to that point, and I never really made a lot of progress in terms of baseball-specific power past, past college, really. I wasn't a very powerful hitter. I couldn't throw very fast. And I'm looking at some of these other athletes who are smaller than me, not as strong as me in the weight room, but they were hitting balls 20, 30, 40 feet farther than me, hitting a lot more home runs and stuff like that. So I really wanted to create a book that talked about the different styles of training, the different ways to assess certain athletes, and how to make sure that whatever training you're doing, whatever hard work you're doing in the weight room or wherever, is going to transfer to swing speed and how those adaptations occur. That's really the overall premise of the book. And I think it could be helpful for a lot of kids who might be stuck with certain training methods.
Yeah, well, absolutely. Couldn't agree more. So why you mentioned transfer there? Why don't we kind of get into that to a little bit to start with? So obviously, rotational power, everyone knows it's important. So why don't we get into kind of why it's important to start with, and then how we actually get that to potentially transfer to the sport?
Right, yeah. So, I mean, if you look at MLB baseball players right now, they're hitting more home runs than they ever have before. And if you just look across the league, every single player has hit at least one ball over 100 miles per hour if they've achieved over 100 at bats in a season. So that's pretty crazy to me that that's the prerequisite. Nowadays, you have to hit balls very, very hard if you want to play on the PGA Tour. It's the same thing. More and more players are hitting over 300 yards with their drives than ever before. So rotational power definitely matters, but we can't just go about training blindly. We can't just think, okay, I'm going to add 20 pounds to my bench press this month and it's automatically going to transfer. We have to figure out ways to assess what's happening, what adaptations are occurring. So what I like to do is really try to break down the kinetic sequence and try to figure out certain ways to measure to show that we are becoming more powerful for a rotational swing, a rotational movement that's happening at super fast speeds. So when we weightlift, it's very slow. It's maximal effort, but it's very slow. When we swing and when we throw, it's rotational. It's very fast. We have to find movements that would sort of transfer to that. So what I like to do is sort of break down the kinematics and see that there are certain muscle groups that really work very fast at, that produce force at high speeds. So at the end of the month, however we trained, I like to try to assess that that muscle group, that movement pattern is improving. So something like if I know, for example, the pecs have to be super explosive and produce a lot of force when I swing and throw, I'm going to try to take a medicine ball and throw it as far as I can in a chest pass and make sure that that improves at the end of the month. I don't care how much the bench press improves. I want that chest pass to improve at the end of the month, if you get what I mean.
Yeah, for sure. So if you do you classify things kind of in line with what Bondarchuk does as well? Are you kind of using a similar system there?
Yeah, he does. Yeah, his work is outstanding. Obviously, it's some of the basis of what I really base my training methods on. And yeah, it's kind of just like if you if you know what the goal is, and the goal is no longer just add as much weight in the weight room as possible, if the goal is become a more explosive athlete, improve medicine ball throw velocity, improve jump height, sprint speed, things like that, then all of a sudden you have a direction in your training. So if at the end of the month or the end of the training cycle, you're not improving in those more sports specific power metrics, then you know something's wrong in your training program and you got to try to change it up. But yeah, that's really the way that I like to break it down. There are certain methods that show that an athlete is accelerating faster. But then the other piece of the kinetic sequence is it's not just about speed. We have to have that stiffness quality too, that ability to decelerate within that kinetic sequence, within that swing and within that throw. So there's obviously certain muscle groups and certain actions that we want to be very stiff with and resist. So for example, when we're swinging and throwing, that lead leg really pounds into the ground and has to transfer all that energy up the chain. And we want to be stiff with that front leg. So I like tracking something like a depth jump RSI to create or to show what's happening there in that lead leg when it lands. And to me, that's how you create transfer to sport. It's not just about training like the sport, but it's about having metrics that we are using to show what adaptations are happening and that it matches up with the kinetic sequence.
And do you think within typical kind of the rotational sports that you work with, so baseball, golf, say javelin to an extent, do you think there's way too much emphasis on the kind of simulation instead of stimulation as well?
That's a really interesting way to think about it. I've never really thought about that, but I think we have to trigger adaptations to happen, right? And if you only train in one modality, if you only did high speed work, you're probably going to run yourself into sort of a plateau in training faster than if you were to train the different areas of training that are necessary to continually move forward. You might see really good results for 3 or 4 weeks in training, and then you hit stagnant wall. And that's kind of the idea here. It's we want to make as continual progress as possible. We don't want to just keep pushing athletes and pushing athletes with training methods that aren't working.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. So with obviously you've talked a little bit about deceleration there, and I think you posted something about this like the last few days on social media. What are you using? Because obviously we've got to be able to, if we're going to be able to accelerate it, we need to be able to decelerate it at the end of the day. It's that old saying, what goes up must come down.
Yeah.
So how are you teaching those deceleration mechanics? Because I'm guessing, and this is like, feel free to go down the rabbit hole here, but the standard kind of Palov press, probably not going to cut it when it comes to the speeds that we're seriously looking to decelerate high velocities, like swinging that bat.
Yeah. Yeah. And you might be right. I think like something like a Palov press could work with certain athletes, those that are very underdeveloped, you know, not having trained a whole lot. They're going to probably see great results with it, but you're right. Mm-hmm. After a while, we have to find ways to create even better transfer than before. So we can't keep doing the same training methods. I would say the way the kinetic sequence works, it's like one segment accelerates and then must decelerate in order to allow for that next segment to maximize its acceleration window and so on. So when looking at something like the core or the torso, it has to rotate very fast and then it has to stop on a dime and transfer energy into the upper limbs. So I would say something like a dumbbell rotational swinging exercise where we're trying to rotate back and forth, or something like a medicine ball swing and hold type exercise would be really, really good to sort of train with those athletes who might be a little more advanced than just the Palov press, if you get what I mean.
Yeah, no, for sure. I think the Palov press is definitely got its place. I don't want anyone to take that out of context, but I think it's got its place in foundational programs and just getting to like hold and kind of learn how to brace, essentially, which is obviously a foundational movement for the core. We've got to learn how to maintain that position. But then I think it's only going to be useful for so long. Once you learn how to kind of maintain and brace, then we need to be able to move on and train what people might call as like a functional core, like so to speak.
That's a good way to put it. And something I've been thinking about just very recently is it's not so much about trying to predict what training methods will work. I think all you have to do is if you have some measurables, like let's say the ones that I like to track for baseball players and javelin throwers, I like to track a rotational medicine ball throw for the radar gun for velocity. And I like to track an overhead throw for the radar gun for velocity. And we'll track some other things as well. But if I know that those methods, or those metrics, sorry, are improving over time, then I know the last 4 weeks of training produced adaptations that will help them in their sport. If mm-hmm. those metrics are not improving, then I just have to look at and see what happened, what adaptations did occur. Did they get stronger in the weight room, but not faster speeds? Did they jump farther, but they didn't get stronger in their upper body to improve that medicine ball throw velocity? Just have to look at the last 4 or 5 weeks of training, and then that will, you know, help you in your next 4 or 5 weeks. It's sort of a compass. It's a direction for your programming that helps a lot.
Oh, for sure. And I think one of my first ever kind of mentors said, if you're not assessing, you're guessing.
Yeah.
And I think that's never been like more true. It couldn't be more true. And it's how often with that kind of, if you're not assessing, you're guessing theme in mind, how often are you actually like reassessing your guys? Is it kind of monthly, like you say, or does it depend on the exercise and the adaptation?
Yeah. Well, what I like to do is track, measure as much as possible in the weight room. That makes my job so much easier. So if an athlete does have a medicine ball throw in their program, they're going to do it for the radar gun or for distance. And we're going to track that, you know, having that external feedback is huge for athletes. They love to compete with each other. They love seeing the number, and it increases intensity and effort and all those great things that we want the athlete to have in training. So having bar speeds, medicine ball throw velocities, sprint speeds, jump height, jump distance, things like that attached to every single exercise they're doing is really important. So over time, you'll kind of see increases, but at the very least, we will have a reassessment day every 4 weeks or so.
And is that, so a lot of people listening to this, maybe in the collegiate setting, working in kind of larger baseball groups and things like that. Do you see, obviously in your kind of more private facility and things like that, that you work out of, it's a little, potentially a little bit easier in order to kind of radar gun the individual and things like that. Do you see that being like adaptable within the larger setting as well? Or
yeah, that's a great point. I've been asked that before. How would I apply this, radar gunning medicine ball throws for a group of 20 or 25 individuals? And fortunately, I work in a baseball facility, so we already have the radar guns and the nets and everything right next to the weight room. So it works really well for me. But yeah, I guess what I would try to do is sort of pick maybe a day of the week where the athletes can compete against each other and you can track everyone's medicine ball throw velocity all in one setting. I think that I've done that with teams before and it's a really, really cool environment. But that is a good point. On a day-to-day basis, you're probably not going to be able to get all those metrics in one day. But if you run a large organization, find time to have sort of a competition day or a showcase type day or something like that, where you can get measurables on athletes and they're working on some of these sport specific training modalities as well.
And I think that competition factor is huge as well, because what I do with my tennis guys, we have a thing called like Big Serve Wednesday. Mm-hmm. The name essentially just gets the guys amped up. It's the only reason it's called that. And I give them 10 balls and they've just got to chase. I don't care if the ball goes in or out of the court. They've just got to chase the highest velocity possible. And we're looking for those higher output adaptations. And we're measuring everything. That's why we're using the radar gun for every guy. And admittedly, it takes longer. It's part of practice and the coaches buy into it. But it's one of those things that it's like, are we better off doing this or are we better off doing something else? And luckily, I think it's a very important part of practice, that one day a week where we can really get after it on our high output days. And then we do a similar thing. Luckily, we've got some technology with the like timing gates and we've got a turfed area in the weight room. Mm-hmm. So we can have like complexes where we might squat or jump and then go to our timing gates and the girls will select their name on the iPad, for example, and then they just do their 10 yard sprint. And
that's awesome. Come up on
screen and then they can compete. They'll do two sprints after every like loaded power exercise, for example. And then it's naturally kind of testing's training, training's testing. I think the more you can get that as a cycle and become one, I think the better off you're going to be.
I agree 100%. And so now what you're doing is you're shifting the athlete's mindset away from, I need to bench press 300 pounds, I need to deadlift 500 pounds. No, you can do those and you should attack those in your training very, very intensely. But the goal is to become a more explosive athlete that can hit a ball harder, throw a ball faster, things like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 100%. And I think that's the thing that I constantly emphasize to our athletes. I don't really care what you squat, bench, deadlift, whatever. It's the stuff that happens on the court. So what, like, how, not necessarily even how quickly can you serve, but because in tennis, it's very much, are we trying to hit different types of serve, just like it is when you're pitching a baseball. It's not always about velocity. Sometimes it's good to go as hard as you can, but it's going to depend. And I think getting them to understand, look, how do you feel on the court? That's one of the most often asked questions I ask my athletes. How do you feel? Do you feel like you're getting better? Are you perceiving your environment better? Are you moving better? And I think that's the way to go. It's not all about, obviously, bench press numbers and things like that. On that, do you think that, I know we talked a little bit off camera before we started actually recording. Do you think that, therefore, like, strength is potentially misunderstood? Do you think it's
more
towards heavy lifting?
Yeah, like you hit the nail on the head. Like, strength is often talked about only in the context of lifting a heavy weight, you know, producing as much force as you can at a slow speed. But in reality, all strength is, it's something that we can display. It's the maximal amount of something that we can display. So if I am strong at slow speeds, that doesn't necessarily mean that I am strong at high velocities, or, you know, throwing a 5-pound medicine ball. I have just about every athlete that I train that's over the age of 15 can throw a medicine ball much faster than me, even though I can out bench press them. So when you think of strength in context of their sport, they are more well prepared to produce power or whatever strength that you want to call it, whatever you want to call it. They're able to produce more output in their sport because they are stronger at high velocities. They produce more force at high speeds than me, even though I'm more forceful overall. And that's kind of like a really interesting conversation, is this idea of, should we ever have high velocity athletes, tennis, baseball, javelin, should they ever train at heavy strength? Is there any transfer there? As I talked about briefly off camera, I've worked with Chris Beardsley before, and he has a book called Strength is Specific. And this really started changing my mindset on certain things. And he's a very big proponent of, if you train high velocity athletes, a majority of your training should be high velocities. And I don't necessarily know if I agree with it, because I do see that maximal effort strength training transfers as well. It's just, we really have to make sure we're assessing the athlete as an individual, that they need this high velocity strength more, or they need this heavy strength training more. So I like to use what's called a force velocity profile. Super simple method. All you do is, like what I do is, I'll take a supine or sit up style overhead throw with a 10 pound, 6 pound, and 2 pound medicine ball. So we got that heavy ball, that medium ball, and the light ball. And what you're going to do there is just track on a graph how hard they throw each ball on average. And you're going to see that some of these really smaller, skinny, weak kids have a very vertical looking profile, where they throw the 2 pound really well, but that 10 pound ball, they don't throw so well. The 6 pound ball, they don't throw so well. And then there's a huge spike where that 2 pound ball is. And then you'll have athletes like me who are very strong, but slow. I throw the 10 pound ball harder than everybody else, but the 6 pound and the 2 pound, I don't throw as hard as anyone else. So it's, you can really see more a horizontal profile. And that's a really, really easy way to just see, okay, we can get better training methods for this specific individual because I know they need more strength, or I know they need more speed training in their program.
So just for those listeners that maybe like the idea of force velocity profiling, and I'll use the example you gave there, and just correct me if I'm wrong. So you said you throw the heavy ball quite a long way, but then you're not quite as efficient or effective on the lighter ball.
Correct.
So just for those that maybe don't fully understand what that means, like what would training look like for you? If we were trying to get you to the big leagues, like how do we improve your force velocity profile and to make sure you can actually hit the ball further when it comes to kind of hit on the mound, you know?
Yeah. So the main thing that I look at as the determining factor is the central nervous system. So the way the CNS works is it dictates how forceful a movement will be or how fast the movement will be, depending on the force will be dictated by the overall threshold of motor unit recruitment. So if I'm going to lift, let's say if I'm going to lift this marker right here very slowly all the way up, it's a very low threshold motor unit. If I wanted to lift this marker and it weighed 80 pounds, I'm going to have maximal threshold motor unit in order to lift it at that speed. So that's just the overall idea there behind force production. But then if I wanted to throw this marker off of the ceiling, I would have a higher level of what's called rate coding or motor unit firing rate. And this is where I would really train myself with a lot more, kind of a mix. I wouldn't do all high velocity work, but I would definitely do a lot more medicine ball throws, slams, run and gun throws or over speed type throws where I'm trying to go at a faster speed than what I could normally do with that movement. A lot of plyometric exercises as well and sprints. Exercises like that would probably make up about 60 to 70% of my overall training, like a very high volume of those types of exercises. But the other idea here is that I don't think we can only work at high speeds with those athletes. And one of the reasons why I remember Greg Rose from TPI talking about how he used to train Rory McIlroy. And the one thing he talked about was that Rory came in as like a 14 or 15 year old. He was a really skinny kid, but he can swing extremely fast, like faster than anybody else's age. He could hit like a PGA Tour player, but he was so weak and unstable at his joints that he wound up getting back problems and hip issues and stuff like that. So he starts deadlifting, he starts strength training, and all of a sudden the injuries go away. The joint stability is much better. His ability to be stiff and resist excessive rotation at the spine is so much better. So I would make sure that when training someone that's velocity deficient like myself, I still have like 20 or 30% of my program be strength maintenance work, high effort isometrics, high effort eccentric work to make sure that the joints can withstand all of those rotational and high velocity forces I'm placing on it.
No, I like that. So essentially like McIlroy's coming to the gym and he's just so velocity dominant in everything he's doing, but not producing enough kind of force to a degree or even strong enough to kind of withstand those high velocity decelerations. So he might, like you said, he's getting lower back pain. He's getting potentially oblique injuries and things like that as well. And then Just while we're on that, I know we touched on deceleration earlier. Are you measuring deceleration ability in any way?
I've just started doing it over the past like month or so, and it's kind of cool. So what I'll do is I'll take various loads, like a 5 pound, a 15 pound and a 25 pound weight, and just rotate back and forth as fast as I possibly can, trying to see how quickly I can rotate in one direction and reverse that direction. The best method of measurement that I've found is just timing it. So I'll record myself on a camera, look at it on the clock on a timer app, you know, when you upload the video, and then see what type of time it looks like. But one thing I've noticed with myself is I can rotate back and forth pretty fast, relatively speaking, with the heavy weight. But when it comes to that light load, there's not a big difference. I'm still not rotating that light load very fast. So that's
when we say heavy weight, are we talking like the 10-pound med ball there versus the 2-pound or?
Right. Yeah. We're rotating with something that's more of a heavy resistance back and forth as fast as I can. I'm very good at rotating with that heavier load, but I've noticed some of the smaller, weaker, fast athletes that I train, they really struggle rotating back and forth with that heavy, like, you know, something over 10 pounds they really struggle with. But you give them a light load, like a 5 pound weight, and they can go back and forth no problem. So that, to me, gives you an assessment where the athlete should be training maybe more maximal force production with the core, maybe more overcoming Palloff presses where they're pulling as hard as they can, more heavy strength type work instead of just high velocity work.
And what range are you looking for there? You kind of, if you look at the clock face, are you going between kind of 10 and 2?
Yeah.
Kind of that range, yeah?
Okay. Yeah, that's what I'd say.
And then just something I thought of then, as part of that assessment protocol, could you, and I don't know if you do this or not, I know we talked as well off air about the push band and things like that as looking at velocity. Have you looked at using the push band as kind of a deceleration?
Yeah. Like, the only problem with the push band is right now, at least, they don't really track, you know, how quickly you stop or how long it takes you to do the movement. The only thing that I've found is it does it works as an accelerometer, so it'll tell you meters per second, and you know, that's about all you could really work with there. So hopefully in the future they will have some sort of a measure for that, but not yet.
You've got to get in touch with them and get that patented, get that on there.
Oh, man, that would be so awesome.
So the other thing I actually thought of there, it's essentially just working with like biometric feedback. I wonder if you could say, okay, well, maybe part of our assessment protocol is we're going to hold this 10-pound med ball in like a Palov position. We're going to rotate between 10 and 2. You're going to do a total of, I don't know, 5 reps or 10 reps, and then we're going to time it. And then I wonder if you could say, okay, well, 10 reps is the test. It took you 8 seconds to do 10 reps, for example. Mm-hmm. And then I just wonder if you do that, you can repeat that, or even as a training protocol, you're moving backwards and forwards as quick as possible. And then we're looking at, okay, today is a 5% velocity drop-off day. And then we have a little chart, which we do in the weight room anyway. But mm-hmm. we say, okay, well, 5% of 8-point-something seconds is, my math's not that good, but whatever it is, you know?
Yeah. Dude, that's an outstanding idea, actually. I'm actually going to try this now.
There you go.
That's a really great idea. I think, because now you're giving the athlete that feedback too that every athlete wants to have. Like, mm-hmm. you know, the athletes don't just want to chase a burn. They don't just want to feel sore when they're done working out. They're athletes, they're competitive, they want output. That's part of their genetic makeup or whatever. But yeah, I really like that protocol idea as well. It's something interesting to try.
I think that's something, it's something that I've used in the past in terms of just squatting. And I know Carl Dietz, I think, talks about it in triphasic training. And when I've done it with my guys in the past, we do banded squats and we'll just say, okay, well, you've got 3 reps. And when, if you don't have any velocity-based training equipment or anything like that, it's super easy because you've got a guy with a stopwatch and you're good to go. So as soon mm-hmm. as you've unracked the bar, you take that step back. As soon as the descent starts, the goal is to try and move 3 reps as quick as possible. As soon as they come up to the top on that 3rd rep, we hit stop on the stopwatch and it's okay. You did 3 reps in X amount of time. And then obviously, depending on the level of fatigue you're wanting to induce, then it's either a 2%, a 3%, or a 5% drop-off.
Right.
You go 5%, then it's going to be potentially up to 72 hours before you do a similar velocity kind of focused session. So that's something that I've used in the past and had pretty good success.
To me, that's the way to do it because now, I think the way you're training all of a sudden is no longer just to beat athletes up. We're not trying to make them super sore and super tired. We're trying to build them. And over those weeks of training, you should see a subsequent improvement because they're not training in a fatigued state anymore. You're maximizing that motor unit recruitment because the central nervous system is not fatigued. You're maximizing the overall muscular output because the muscles are not sore and damaged from previous training sessions. So now we can start to create these adaptations that you want to see. There's such a big difference. There was a recent study that came out about velocity loss per set. And when athletes were weight training with a lower velocity loss per set, where they were keeping velocity levels really high, they saw a much greater content of type 2X muscle fibers in their biopsy. So it was like, wow, that's what we want to create. We don't want to create big, bulky dudes that can't swing fast. We want strong, explosive guys that can transfer to the sport. That's where it comes from.
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head there with obviously high velocities at appropriate loads, we get essentially an optimal level of motor unit recruitment. So we're going to mm-hmm. drive those adaptations that we want to see, while more importantly as well, we don't induce fatigue. So we've got that appropriate drop off. So that for someone, and this has happened with myself training athletes in the past, we've used a similar protocol for like a prone row or a bench pull technique, and where we'll hit X amount of reps or as many reps as possible in certain seconds, or you'll say, okay, 5 reps, we'll time it. And it might be the program for the day might be 4 sets, but mm-hmm. I've had guys be able to stay within that velocity drop off for like 16 sets, but that's optimal. That's like, these guys are rowers. So mm-hmm. obviously like pulling's their game. they're fantastic at that. If you put that with maybe a rugby player or a lineman, that's not exactly their game. But I think that definitely becomes more specific to the sport. And that's very specific, more importantly, to the individual. 16 sets for you might be five sets for me.
Right.
And I think that's very important.
Right. I agree with that 100%, man. You hit the nail on the head.
And I think that actually what you talked about there with the kind of motor unit recruitment and the type 2X fiber, have you seen the videos of, is it Werner Günther, like jumping around on YouTube, like a madman? So he was I believe, like a shot put discus athlete. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, he was huge. He was probably what, like 6'6", 250 pounds at least. And he's monster. Jumping like, yeah, he's jumping better than any athlete I've ever seen. So yeah.
Ridiculous. Yeah. But I think that, so for me, the interesting things behind his training, whether he was kind of on certain substances or not, I think is besides the point here. We needn't go into that. That could be another conversation. But so that guy, if I get this wrong, and no doubt someone can correct me if I do get this wrong, but I believe he only had like 37% kind of fast twitch fibers.
Oh, really?
I think if that's right, if my memory does me right, I haven't kind of talked about this for quite a while, which mm-hmm. is very low. That's typically what you see in like marathon runners.
Mm-hmm.
But then by the time they did muscle biopsies on him, his muscle cross-sectional area was up to, I think it was 85 or 87% type 2.
Oh, wow.
So this guy's just got serious hypertrophy of the right type of fibers from the most appropriate, exactly what you were talking about, hitting the most appropriate velocities in training to stimulate the right adaptations at the right time. So that, mm-hmm. that proves whether or not there were other substances involved.
Yeah.
That proves like those things can be done, and you're not just always kind of type one fiber. That's, mm-hmm. that's you for life. Like if you train appropriately, the right velocities at the right time, we can see these adaptations.
Right. You hit the nail on the head, man. And you know, it's kind of like, it goes back to what we were talking about at the beginning where I want my training to transfer. Okay. We are going to find things to measure to make sure that these training adaptations are happening. Adaptations don't just happen by magic. They happen for a reason. And certainly there are biological reasons that athletes throw harder and swing faster just by growing with puberty and those stages of growth and development. But from a training perspective, we can't just expect to do the same old, and expect an infinite amount of growth. We have mm-hmm. to change with the athlete. We have to see what adaptations are happening and then fix it so that they continuously make those training adaptations that will transfer to the sport.
Mm-hmm. And then, so what, I know we talked about some of the metrics you look at. So you look at like a supine kind of sit up overhead throw. I think you said a med ball, like chest pass for distance. Do you look at distance and velocity on both of those?
Really, velocity is what I've found to be more reliable. But okay. There are some athletes who, it's really what they prefer, to be honest with you. Some athletes do like throwing it for distance. Like the javelin thrower that I train here, he loves tossing it for distance. That's how he likes that. He likes that feedback of throwing it into oblivion. So that's
kind of sport as well.
Yeah, exactly. So he likes to do it. So we'll track that more frequently than velocity. But yeah, what I'll also track with baseball players, I like to track a rotational throw, sort of like a rotational scoop toss, a rotational shot put throw. And it's really interesting how the guys who are the best at that are also the ones who are the best at hitting balls extremely hard and throwing extremely hard. Like, so we have a leaderboard here at our facility, and the leaderboard doesn't have deadlift or squat or bench press anymore. I took that off the board last year, and I only put depth jump RSI from a 12-inch box, 15-yard dash, sprint speed, medicine ball overhead throw, medicine ball rotational scoop toss and shot put throw. And I think that might be it for the training metrics. And then I have baseball, run and gun throw, mound throw, and exit velocity off of a tee. And it's funny how the leaders on all of the exit velocity and baseball specific metrics are all the same leaders for all the medicine ball throws. It's right there for you to see when an athlete comes in the gym. So, and like I said before, it's not that we don't use heavy strength training. I love using it. It's a tool, not a measure, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm.
I think you've hit the nail on the head there. It is a tool. It's not the measure. And I think whatever you do to come back to the transfer thing, whatever you do, it's got to have predictive value towards the sport. Mm-hmm. So if you look at it from kind of a stats point of view or whatever, there's got to be some sort of correlation there. So like, I love the fact that you said, okay, well, let's get rid of the squats, the bench, the deads, the stuff that's essentially done at very low meters per second. And then we'll see, okay, well, what are we shot put throwing? What are we scoop toss throwing? And then you're looking at the stuff that's essentially got more predictive value. Like you've, well, by the sounds of it, very high predictive value. Cause if you've got a guy that's, I don't know too much about baseball, but if you've got a guy that's like shot put throwing or running gun throwing or whatever, and he's obviously like pitching at higher speeds or whatever, and those two are marrying up, like, correct me if I've missed the two exercises that marry up there, but that's your predictive value right there.
Mm-hmm. 100%. And so what's interesting too, this has happened to me recently as well. You know, what if medicine ball velocity is really good, but baseball specific throwing velocity is still not good? Mm-hmm. That is important information as well, because now you're checking off boxes. We know that this athlete is explosive and powerful at high speeds, but something is specifically wrong with the way they throw a baseball. Maybe they put a death grip on the ball. Maybe they lack mobility to create that whip-like action at the throwing arm. There are different areas that we need to start looking at specific to the throw, as opposed to just saying, well, we need to throw med balls harder because, you know, that's going to make you throw baseball faster. If it's not transferring for that athlete, then you know where to look. That's really important as well.
And I think that's where you start. I think from your perspective, obviously, like, you can work very closely, or maybe even obviously in the private sector, you can be the sports coach. Like, if you're in college, obviously you can't be the sports coach. You're kind of one or the other. And I think it's to be able to have that understanding and have those open lines of communication saying, look, the physical qualities, that box is pretty much checked right now. Now we've got to look at it for, from more of a, maybe a technical point of view. And then what is he limited, like you said, in like external rotation? Like, can he get that whip and generate it? And then are you having, I mean, you might be having conversations with yourself here if you are like the pitching coach, for example, but are there other coaches that you're communicating this with, and how are you kind of breaking down that information so you can apply it back into training?
I always refer out. I'll talk with somebody from like, I have a good friend who works at Tread Athletics. That's a really big throwing velocity based or throwing velocity sort of remote training program. I'll talk with him quite a bit, or any other friends that I have that are really good with throwing, I'll try to send them video and see what's going on. Cause I'll be honest, I'm not the best at it. You know, I can pick up certain things and see the really glaring mistakes with throwing mechanics. But yeah, with the few athletes where medicine ball throwing velocity is not correlating with baseball specific velocity, I try to refer out as much as I can. Cause I know my limitations as a coach right now. I have to get better in those baseball specific areas.
I think that's as all though in the sports performance world. I think we all need to become kind of one almost with the sports coach. If you look at James Smith's Governing Dynamics book, he talks about, like, to an extent, strength conditioning being dead. It's like that kind of amalgamation of the strength coach and the sports coach. And if the sports coach knows everything about S&C, then we're void. We're not needed. So I think the more knowledge you can have on the sport, then 100%, the better off you're going to be.
No, I agree 100%. Like, I've come to this realization a long time ago. Like, I am never going to become the best coach I can be if it's Bill versus the rest of the world. That's not going to work. So you're going to have to reach out to as many people as possible to learn and to help your athletes. At the end of the day, that's all that matters to me, is that the athletes get better. It's not that Bill gets more famous as a strength coach or any of that crap.
And then, like, kind of with that then, obviously, like, looking to grow, being very self-aware, looking for self-development opportunities. What do you think? So, and I see some very cool doodles on the board behind you there of different kind of, I think, muscle contractions and things, which look pretty cool. What's kind of next? What are you looking for in an area? If you maybe yourself developing next, or another area that you're looking to assess with your athletes and ways to train them?
Yeah, I would say my biggest area of growth that I really want to learn about this next year is all about throwing. Like, where can we look for specific assessments for an athlete? What certain drills are going to work best with certain throwers? So, for example, I've been thinking about this. Like, if you have a thrower who really struggles with mobility, what training methods can we do that will specifically target his needs? I've kind of like done this already with strength training, where We know how to assess the athlete, and then we can use that as the compass to go forward. Are there certain weighted balls that we should be using more with certain guys and less with others? That's what I really want to learn about next. Like, how can we make a throwing program specific to that athlete's needs? And then how can we reassess to continually get them moving forward?
And you mentioned weighted balls. I know that's something that you're obviously looking to get into, but are you involved much with that at the moment? I know that's very much a big thing from what I understand. I know my friend Stefan Jones does a lot with kind of weighted bowling and cricket, things like that. If you're not doing it now, how would you potentially integrate it in the future as part of that potentially medicine ball protocols and things like that? Where do you see it fitting?
Yeah. What's weird is I started trying to do like a force velocity profile with a 7, a 6, 5, 4, and 3 ounce ball and to see how they did along the force velocity spectrum there. But the weird thing is I would get athletes who profile as very skinny, weak, force deficient individuals in the weight room, but they would throw the 4 and 3 ounce balls relatively slow. So they did very poorly at that high velocity end. And that really dumbfounded me. So that's something I want to start to learn more about. Like, why is it that those really weak kids struggle so much with the 4 and 3 ounce ball? It makes no sense to me. But I think diving into it a little bit deeper, perhaps maybe they've reached that acceleration peak and they can't decelerate anymore because they're relatively weak in the rear shoulder muscles. Maybe that's it. I'm not sure, to be honest with you. But yeah, I think that would be like the big assessment that I would want to do, is not necessarily training with all the different loaded medicine weighted balls with baseball, but perhaps testing with each one. And that would give you a glimpse of what that athlete should be working with more, perhaps.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think there's so many different rabbit holes you can go down. And I mean, it sounds like, to be honest, you've gone down quite a few of them. it's some of the stuff that you're doing at the moment. I'd advise people, if they haven't already kind of checked you out or anything like that, definitely give you a follow, because that's essentially where I started connecting with you. And I've been very impressed with the content you've been putting out. Just before we actually wrap it up here, I like to finish off and say, do you have any books? I typically say 3 books. Is there any books that you would like to say that have really made an impact on your own learning that you would advise listeners to maybe go and grab hold of and read?
Yeah, I would say the first one is Strength is Specific by Chris Beardsley. That one was really helpful for me a couple years ago when I first read it. And Super Training is a really good one by Verkhoshansky. It's one of the best. It's
one of the hottest as well.
Yeah, there's a lot of information there, but it's almost like you will find something in there that you will like and that will help you. There's just too much in there. It's like an encyclopedia. A little bit off the training specific topic, though, I really like Coach Brett Bartholomew's most recent book as well. It kind of gives an insight into like the sort of mentality behind being a great coach. And it talks a little bit about all the struggles that he had growing up with anxiety and different things, and how that really helped him grow and mature as an individual too. I really like that as well.
Perfect. And then, do you have any advice for kind of young coaches or interns that are currently in the field or wanting to get into the field?
I would say, obviously, read as much as you can. But then when it comes to training athletes, measure as much as you can. Like, keep track of all their metrics that you possibly can, because that's going to teach you more about what is happening in training than any sort of research article might. You can learn about how to train in a book, but it's never really going to come to fruition until you see it happen in real time and you measure it over 4, 5, 6 weeks and you see what adaptations are really happening.
Mm-hmm, for sure. And I'd say, yeah, just ask questions, be around coaches, ask why is that happening? And then if you don't know, like you say, like, go and research it, try and find out. That's going to make you the best coach possible. Just finally here, Bill, I know you're a busy man and we don't want to take too much of your time, but where can people reach out to you if they've got any questions and things like that, like social media?
Yeah, you can find me on Instagram at Bill Miller Training, all one word. And email is BillMillerTraining@gmail.com. And yeah, I'm always open to you know, help anytime that, that somebody has any questions on the training methods that I post about on social media, I always love opening up and having a conversation about it.
Yeah. I mean, and for those that don't follow Bill currently, get on Instagram, give him the follow, cause there is some golden nuggets in there for sure. I delve into every post and it's fantastic. So I just like to say thanks, Bill. I really appreciate taking time out your schedule, and it's been fantastic. And then hopefully we can get you on again at some point.
Oh, thank you so much, man. It means a ton.
Thank you. Have a good day.